This is Max Freedom Long. In this introductory lecture, I wish to tell you of the best kept secret in the world. Not only is it the best kept, but it is one of the oldest of all secrets. From it was derived the mystery plays of ancient Egypt and of later Greece. It was written down only in code language and is to be found in deeply veiled form in the Bible, and traces of it can still be identified in the early writings of yoga and in some of the Eastern religions. What I have to tell you is a story of strange adventure to me, an adventure of a breathless and exciting nature. I came upon the evidence that there had been such a system of knowledge almost by accident, and for almost 50 years I have been unearthing bits and pieces of it. It had been quite lost when I began my research work, and only now are we at last in almost full possession of the priceless knowledge. Oddly enough, we had begun to reinvent the system for ourselves, a bit here, a bit there. In the Western world, only a few years ago, comparatively speaking, we began to think freely for ourselves in the matter of religion. The infant science of psychology was, at the same time, starting to take form. In New England, Phineas Quimby, a watchmaker and mesmerist, led the break away from Christian dogmas in the direction of today's positive or creative thinking. Building on his work, Dresser gave the world New Thought, whose slogan was, "Think right and all will be right." Mary Baker Eddy, another friend of Quimby's, declared that because God was good, and only the good was real, we could deny all evil and all would be set right. Much later, we had the science of religion, the science of mind, all these sects. Correspondence courses were written by self-appointed teachers and sold right and left. The Reverend Norman Vincent Peale grasped the newer ideas and pulled them entirely away from religion in advocating positive thinking or creative thinking. One of his contemporaries was Napoleon Hill, whose book, Think and Grow Rich, had little enough of God in it, but told how Andrew Carnegie's creative thinking had helped him and his friends to make fortunes. He held up as examples F.W. Woolworth, John Wanamaker, Woodrow Wilson, and George Eastman. Eventually, self-suggestion was added to the new trend of thought. Maxwell Maltz, in his book Psycho-Cybernetics, made much of the use of suggestion aimed at the subconscious and laid out a rigorous course of training in which feedback mechanisms were utilized with cybernetics. Having gradually escaped from the hindering dogmas of Christianity, modern man had, unthinkingly, begun to recover or rediscover Huna. Some of the pioneer thinkers had taken the first steps. Everything was fine and good and helpful, except that something was missing, at least for most people. And they found that the new method of using creative thinking was difficult. For some reason, it didn't work for them. May I venture to suggest that what was lacking was the undiscovered two-thirds of psychology, most of the materials of psychical research, and almost all of the vastly more modern, reasonable, and sophisticated religion of which I am about to tell you. My research work began in Hawaii. As a young man, I visited the curator of the Bishop Museum of Natural History in Honolulu, Dr. William Tufts Brigham, a great student. Dr. Brigham had spent 40 years studying the Hawaiians their society, their religion, and other aspects of the Polynesian culture. I had heard that the Hawaiian priests, who were called kahunas, performed many seemingly unbelievable feats. I had heard that they had firewalked on very hot lava after it had overflowed from a volcano. I asked Dr. Brigham whether or not there was any truth in the reported firewalking. "Yes," he said, "these kahuna priests firewalked in my days here in early Hawaii." He went on to tell me how he himself had walked across the hot lava. The three old kahunas who went with him crossed barefooted. He had burned off his heavy mountain boots and socks, and yet his feet remained unburned. No one had treated his feet. All that the natives did was to pray for protection from the heat, and this protection was given. I continued my questioning and learned that these kahuna priests had also done remarkable healing. "What have these people got?" I demanded. Dr. Brigham replied, "A system of psychology and religion which is pure enough and close enough to its source, whatever that is, to work for them. I have tried for 40 years to learn how they perform their magic, but to no avail." After that first meeting with Dr. Brigham, I spent the next 16 years in Hawaii trying to learn the secret for myself. I continued the research later in California, and by 1936 had gained a fair knowledge of the basic principles of the secret lore. I wrote a book on my findings entitled Recovering the Ancient Magic. It was published in England, and among those who read it was Reginald Stewart, a war correspondent and a student who had run into the ancient lore in the keeping of a tribe of Berbers in the Atlas Mountains of North Africa. He wrote to me and was able to tell me many things. As a young man, he had been befriended by a woman magician, or kahuna, to use the Hawaiian word. Her title was Queen Kwahini, and she demonstrated the workability of the ancient system. In fact, she took young Stewart as a blood son and started to teach him, together with her 17-year-old daughter, the ancient beliefs and practices. Unfortunately, she had only made a beginning of her instructions when she was accidentally killed by a stray bullet from a battle going on in a valley between two warring tribes. There was no other teacher to be found, and Stewart gave up and went back to England, carrying his notes with him. Years later, when reading my book, he realized that I was writing about the same system he had learned, in part, from her. Many of the special words that his teacher had used to describe her beliefs were almost identical with those I had given in the Hawaiian. He sent me a letter and soon was sharing what he knew with me. By good luck, he had been instructed in the matter of the religion of the secret system, while I had been working up from the bottom, unearthing the psychology. Together, we managed to piece together almost a complete outline of the secret lore. Strangely enough, the secret had, and still has, it was called, and had been handed down from parent to child, as a secret for untold centuries. In Hawaiian, the word for secret is huna, which is spelled H-U-N-A, huna. And the priests who knew and used it were called keepers of the secret, or kahunas. Among other things which the Queen Kwahini, or woman kahuna, had told Stewart was the story, by then legendary, of how her tribe had once been a part of 12 sub-tribes who had known and used huna and who lived in or near Egypt. She believed that her tribe had helped build the Great Pyramid by levitating the stones. But the part of the story which is most fascinating and provocative, was that the Kahuna people were able to look ahead and saw that their lore was being lost. Greatly disturbed, they used their psychic powers to look around the world, searching for a good place in which they might preserve it, a place to which they might migrate, and in which their lore would not suffer loss. They saw, of all the empty places on earth, the islands of the Pacific, and they set out to go there. The Queen Kwaihini's tribe, however, acted as a form of rear guard, she said, and when the 11 other tribes had escaped by way of the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean, her unit was cut off and forced to escape north. Eventually, they found the Berber nation, or founded it, or became a part of it, we don't know. The 11 tribes who sailed away in the great double canoes, so said the Queen, were the fabled lost tribes of Israel. The 11 tribes which got away evidently divided. At least one tribe traveled along the coast of Africa to Madagascar. Some of them settled there, and today half of that island, 2,000 years later, is inhabited by a light brown people who speak a language which is a dialect of the Polynesian. It is called Malagsi. Other tribes migrated past Arabia and on into India. In India, they left traces of their ideas, but I found little of their language. Whereas in Madagascar, the language provides the evidence, in India, it comes from the ideas which were left behind. The Kahunas, or native keepers of the secret, must have made friends with the religious men of that period in India. Apparently, the teachers of yoga were initiated into the Huna beliefs. Unfortunately, the beliefs gradually became contaminated. As an example, breathing exercises, so vital to the practitioners of Huna, are also important in yoga. The original purpose of these breathing exercises became lost, and the yogi began to experiment. Over the years, most of the Huna concepts became mixed and muddled, until finally very little of practical application of the original system exists in yoga today. On the other hand, the original Huna beliefs were still pure when Buddha established his doctrine as a reform of the Brahmanism of his day. Obviously, there was a knowledge of Huna on the part of Buddha and his followers because there are esoteric elements of Buddhism which can be understood only by knowing the Huna system. For example, the concept of attaining nirvana, originally understood as a blowing out, like the blowing out of a candle, thus blending back into the source of all life and ceasing to exist, takes on an entirely different meaning when one understands Huna. Blowing out is done with breath, and breath is very important in the Huna system. From the Far East, the tribes moved on, possibly up through Sumatra and Java Straits. The Madagascar tribe did not join the others in the Pacific. There were only 10 dialects represented there. The other 10 are represented in New Zealand, in Hawaii, in Tahiti, in Samoa, and in the smaller islands. Because of the remote location of these islands, the people were able to preserve their beliefs and practices for nearly 2,000 years, free from the influence of other beliefs. To place Huna accurately in history is difficult. It appears to have been a fully perfected and workable system from the very first. One can only guess that it was brought to Egypt or to the Near East from some other land, perhaps one such as the traditional lost Atlantis. The first traces of Huna are found in the glyphs or pictures of the early writing of the early Egyptians. There were 10 parts or elements of importance in Huna, and the Egyptians pictured these in their glyphs. They also used word symbols to name some of the elements. And unless one knew the meaning of the glyphs and of the symbol words, one was an uninitiated outsider. In short, the secret was hidden by a code. As I was to learn late in my studies, the code was built on a language which was almost identical with that used in Polynesia of the later period. It may well have been the common language of the Huna tribe in Egypt, although it eventually developed 11 slightly different dialects. In some of the lands visited by the migrating Huna tribes, words of their language were left behind, but usually the words were lost and only the ideas left. In Polynesia, if there ever was a written language, it was quickly forgotten, and all history and knowledge was handed down by word of mouth. The kahunas trained young men to memorize long chants and once a year had them recite. They corrected any slight change in words and in this way kept the language of the code from being changed. We may say that the Huna lore first appeared about 7,000 years ago in Egypt. It was recorded in the glyph writings at a later date and was all but lost when the glyph or picture writing moved from the use of pictures to the syllabic or quasi-alphabetic order and then to the demotic or shortened writing of the later time. By the time the Bible was being written, there were Hebrew initiates, and they very carefully inserted bits of coded Huna into Genesis. Later on, Isaiah was heavily loaded with coded Huna. And shortly after the 12 tribes had migrated, there were written the four Gospels, which gave us four versions of the Jesus story, and hidden in the telling was coded Huna of the finest. To understand what Jesus taught in secret to his disciples, one must first learn the code. The first gospel versions appear to have written originally in the language of the code, the language that was later to become the tongue of Polynesia. The same is to be said of decoding the secret in Genesis and Isaiah, all written originally in the Polynesian, translated back into the Hawaiian, which is the best preserved of the dialects. You can then add the symbol words and the meanings of the roots of the ordinary words, words used by the kahunas, and with patience, you can begin to get at the hidden meanings. It is supposed that the 12 tribes left their homeland in or near Egypt and began their migrations near the year 1 AD, or it may have been a little earlier. All we can be sure of is that they left before the four Gospels were written and allowed by accident to fall into the hands of the uninitiated, who mistook the stories for a true history, and in the hands of Paul, who was not an initiate, became dogmatized and greatly distorted. When Hawaii was discovered by the white people some 2,000 years later, they found that the natives knew all the Bible stories. They even had a fuller version of the story of the creation. They knew of Noah and the flood, Jonah and the whale. This gives us the date of their departure from the Holy Land, for they knew nothing at all of Jesus, Mary, the disciples, the crucifixion, or the Holy Ghost. It was plain to see that even if they had been visited by some early Christian priest, as had been guessed by the missionaries before the year 1500 AD, that priest would certainly not have told them the Old Testament Bible stories without stressing the dogmas of the New Testament. For almost 2,000 years, the kahunas had lived in Hawaii, and the secret system of Huna had been preserved. The higher grades of kahunas were able to look into the future to some extent. They had their herb doctors and their religious healers who could often get amazing results. They knew all and more than we do of psychology. They knew all and more than we do of the materials of psychical research. Recognized five kinds of ghosts against our two. They were experts at ESP, as we call it, and used telepathy with great certitude, sending messages around the island in a way that amazed the white people. They could heal broken bones instantly, firewalk, and do many other amazing things. But the impact of white civilization was too much. The thing that they had feared in Egypt caught up with them. From the discovery years beginning in 1778 until 1820, when the first missionaries arrived, civilization demanded its pound of flesh. The Huna lore was gradually lost. Hearing that the missionaries were bringing a finer, better, more civilized religious system to them, they outlawed the kahunas and tore down the native temples. But when the missionaries arrived, they found that their hopes were not justified. It was too late then to recall the outlawed kahunas. They were gone. And Huna was, to all intents and purposes, dead, lost beyond recall. Only by listening to tales of what had been done or what was being done on the quiet by a few half-trained kahunas, then by breaking the code, was I able to restore Huna. You have now heard the story. Should you wish to learn step by step what the keepers of the secret knew and used, at least insofar as we have come to know the ancient lore, a study group should be formed. Lectures are available, and in them, I will, to the best of my ability, try to teach you what will pass as an initiation into the best-kept secret of them all. This is Max Freedom Long speaking, and this is the second lecture on Huna. In early Egypt, and with the Hebrews of a still later date, Huna was largely taught through the presentation of mystery plays or dramatizations of the thing to be taught. The method is still used by the Masons after a fashion. The play is staged, and after each act, the master of mysteries points out the hidden meanings of what has been dramatized. In these sophisticated times, when all men can read and write, and when everyone is in a hurry, we leave the lovely presentations of the mystery plays and get down to summaries and outlines, get down to the hard, dry bones of fact. May I begin my presentation of Huna by inviting all listeners to consider the Huna system as simply another of the world's great religions. Look at it as part of a comparative religion study. You do not have to believe anything or to accept anything as final and beyond question. You will be very modern and use the latest study methods. You will reserve judgment while you use constructs or as ifs. You will say, in this construct, let us suppose that a certain proposed thing is true, and go on with that line of thought and see where it leads. I fully realize that many of you are conditioned from childhood to one line of belief or another, and that we must, at all costs, avoid treading on the toes of one's religion or even of one's politics. The things we have taught our subconscious to accept and believe in are sacrosanct. We go against them at our peril. But by making constructs, we can let sleeping dogs lie and walk careful weeder shins around and about while getting a liberal education in new and different ideas in very old but very different ideas. Please remember that while I am completely sold on Huna myself, I am not asking or expecting you to be. I am offering you such information as I have been able to come by, and I am not setting myself up as a teacher. All I am asking is a hearing. Once you have heard me out, you can check my findings for yourself or simply accept or reject the materials. In passing, may I say that the knowledge of Huna has been rejected by the very ones whom I thought would be most eager to know it. I had discovered an inner teaching coded into the four Gospels, and I was all expectation as I set out to tell the wonderful news to the priests and preachers, all the devout Christians, who should, I thought, more than welcome the news of what I had found. But I soon learned that nothing is so blindly reactionary as religion and religionists. After four attempts to get a hearing from the Pope at Rome, I gave up. The sending of books and letters got me nothing but silence. From you, I hope for at least a hearing. Huna must not be lost again. We must retain it, if for no other reason than for its great historic value. It was the fountainhead from which many other religions flowed. Of course, the science of psychology has been evolving of recent years without the help or guidance from Huna. But as a science of mind, it is still very far behind Huna. It teaches only the conscious and subconscious parts of mind, and it treats of the mind of man only while he is alive, not even admitting that there is such a thing as mind after death. But that is better than religion could offer, with its one and only mind, the immortal soul. But religion did have the advantage of teaching that the soul survived death. In my introductory lecture, I told you that Huna was first identified as existing in early Egypt. If you wish to check on this, you will have a fascinating study awaiting you. Go to a good library and ask for all of Budge's books, Budge's translation of the Book of the Dead, his book on the Egyptian religions, his book on the Egyptian language. You will find the little glyphs or pictures and learn which ones were selected to act as an alphabet in the middle years when the writings were at their best. But pay a special attention to the words. They are spelled out with the glyph alphabet first, and then, to make sure that the reader got the meaning, a little picture or glyph was added at the end. It is in these little pictures that you will find the evidence that Huna was well known before the alphabet was developed. Look up the word for mummy. That stood for the physical body. And as each man had three souls, it was the home or residence of the souls in life and after death until the move into the heavenly place was made. Next, look for the name of the souls or entities who lived in the body, the spirits. You will find it under spirit. They are the cat, K-H-A-T, which is really another name for the body. Then find the sahu, S-A-H-U, which was the spirit body and was lasting and incorruptible. Then the ka, K-A, which was a soul which could come back to the mummy at times, a subconscious, if you please. Then the ba, or heart soul, was more like our conscious mind self. Then the ku, K-H-O-O, was a spirit soul. Then the kabit, K-H-A-I-B-I-T, a very important thing. This was the man's shadow and was a very important part of him. The sekhem, S-E-K-H-E-M, was the vital power and was also very important, often being mentioned in connection with the souls. The ren was the name of the man personified, and his Osiris, Osiris, was the whole man. That is, all his body's forces and spirits considered as one unit. This will keep you busy for a few evenings, but always watch for the little picture that follows the spelled-out name of the part of the man. It will give you more exact information in some cases about the thing named. Please remember that Mr. Budge, whose definitions I have been reading above, did not know Huna, and so became rather confused in his efforts to say what the above-mentioned words meant to the Huna initiates of Egypt. The Egyptian glyph code is the most difficult to break, and we need it mainly as evidence of the antiquity of Huna. For your next evening at the library, ask for a copy of the older Hawaiian English Dictionary. The new one is very poor for this work. And look up the words Unihipili, Unihipili. Also the word Uhane, Uhane. And the word Aumakua, Aumakua. These will do for a start, but will show you how hard it was to break the code and to see that in those words we have the conscious mind and the subconscious and the superconscious. The latter still is only partly accepted by psychology. The Hawaiian, like other dialects in Polynesia, was a simple language. It was not agglutinated and did not change words to make tense or gender or number, using special separate words to show these changes. What made it ideal for the code work was that the words were often made up of little root words, which, when translated, each root by itself gave the hidden meaning or part of the hidden meaning or code meaning of the whole word. What complicates the breaking of the code is the further fact that certain words were used as the symbol of some part or element of the Huna system. And if you did not know what a word stood for, you were simply out of luck. For instance, there was the word for grasshopper. This one stumped me for a long time. In early Egypt, the little picture glyph of a grasshopper is to be found in the tombs with the mummy, as also are the glyphs for the bee, for honey, and for water, and the spider as well. In the Hawaiian, we find the strange use of the grasshopper as a symbol of something, but at first I had no idea what that something could be. The word for grasshopper is Unihipili, which also means the same thing as the Egyptian mummy, except for the fact that the Hawaiian simply cleaned the flesh from the arm and leg bones and considered them as the mummy, to be hidden in a cave or preserved and venerated if they were the bones of a famous chief. But there was also the definition given in the old dictionaries of one name of a class of gods, while Aumakua is another. I am quoting here. They were departed spirits of decomposed persons, end quote. Only by translating and considering the meaning of the roots of the word can one get at the real Huna meaning. It was the word used by the kahunas to indicate what we call the subconscious. None of the roots have anything to do with a grasshopper, or with spirits, or with the arm and leg bones of the deceased. But they all describe some characteristic of the subconscious. Be patient and bear with me while I show you how the root translations serve to help break that part of the code. The root pili, P-I-L-I, means united or joined or belonging to a person, to adhere to something. That is like the subconscious is belonging or is a closely joined soul, joined to the conscious mind self. The root nihi describes secretiveness, to work silently and softly, and the subconscious certainly does do that. The root yu the word is unihipili. The root U means a self, an I. The priests had an alternate word, uhinipili, for the subconscious, which repeats some of the roots but contains others which provide additional meanings. Uhi root carries the meaning of a weak voice which is smothered by another voice, the voice of the conscious mind. Another meaning is to hide, to be secretive. All these descriptions aptly describe the subconscious mind and the way it works. They show that it is secretive, that it is closely attached to the conscious mind, that it will do things only when it wishes to do so, and that it also hides things, such as its complexes or fixations, and is the center of the emotions. Uhane, U-H-A-N-E, which is Hawaiian for the conscious mind, I found that you meant a self and that hane means to talk. The root words give the description of the conscious mind as the self which talks. The human being is the only animal which is able to talk and convey its ideas. These examples show the method used in finding the hidden meanings in words used by the kahunas. The separate meanings of the root words describe the ideas hidden behind the word or elaborate its meaning. The Hawaiian code word for the superconscious is aumakua, A-U-M-A-K-U-A, and makua as a root means parental or a pair of gods, and it is the parental part of man. The root also means very old. The translation for the word aumakua, given by a student of the Hawaiian lore, is utterly trustworthy parental spirit. An 1865 Hawaiian dictionary translates the words as, I quote, one who can be trusted as a child trusts a parent. One would call the superconscious a god, who is trusted to love the subconscious and conscious with whom it is connected. It helped us as guide throughout our lives. It was the guardian angel, if you please. There were other words, as I've said, which were used to symbolize things in Huna. In later lectures, we will come to them as we study the vital forces, telepathy, and the fine art of making a prayer in the Huna manner. Many of these words are found in the four Gospels. However, we find the water of life, the seeds, and the light, all Huna symbols of something that lies behind and beyond the outer meanings. The Egyptian word stork signifies a soul, and as they believed that a man had three selves or souls, one finds their word for spirits reinforced at the end of the little glyph pictures. It is three storks standing crowded together, one right behind the other, making them almost one bird. It is a delightful and meaning symbol. To digress for a moment, let me speak of a strange thing. When Easter Island was discovered, it was found that the natives had a glyph writing, the use of which had been forgotten. They possessed what were called paddle boards, and on them had been carved glyphs, which Werner Wolf, in his 1948 book, Island of Death, describes and which he shows to be very similar to the Egyptian glyphs. For my part, I am convinced that there was a strong similarity, even to a glyph which strongly resembles our three storks marching in unison for the symbol of the spirits of man. Every religion has a version of the creation story. The early initiates of the lore of Huna often told tales which explained concepts of their secret science. One of these legends tells us that when the gods created man, they used two kinds of clay, red and white. In this way, man was able to have two spirits live in him. In modern terms, the man of two colors of clay remains a conscious and a subconscious pair of minds or spirits or selves. The initiates believe that these two parts of human consciousness were two very different and separate spirits or minds or selves. Modern religions recognize only two parts of man, a body and a soul. However, traces of Huna have found their way into many modern religions. Eastern religions make reference to a lower and higher self as resident in the body of man. And from the Greek versions of Christianity, we find a vague addition to the soul in the form of the spirit or breath part. The ancient kahunas regarded the conscious and the subconscious minds of man as two separate and distinct entities. They considered the conscious mind as simply the self that could talk, which lived as a guest within the animal body. It could observe facts and then rationalize these facts inductively. The major job of the conscious mind was to guide and direct the subconscious mind or self. The modern school of psychology recognizes the subconscious. However, the kahunas understood it. They knew its abilities and how to put it to work. To them, the subconscious was regarded as an animal self. This animal self had, like all animals, instinctive guidance to direct it to grow, breathe, digest food, and perform all the involuntary functions. Today, we know that the subconscious controls our automatic responses, such as auto-reflexes. All animals are controlled by their emotions, and the subconscious is the center of our emotional being. The conscious mind's job is to rationalize and control our emotions. The kahunas regarded the subconscious self as a storehouse for all memories, for the thoughts and impressions. Today, we often liken it to a computer in that it serves as a memory bank, but lacks the power to reason inductively. The subconscious mind must rely on the conscious mind for inductive reasoning. The conscious mind can act as a guide and can control the subconscious mind through suggestion. While the subconscious was said to have one's memories as its chief possession, the conscious self possessed the power of speech. It was believed that only when the conscious self was able to act as a guest in the bodily house did the human animal begin to talk. The Egyptians made a god of the power of speech. This god was the Word, and in Christianity we meet the idea in the paragraph, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God," and so on. Also, living as a part of the human consciousness is the superconscious. This term was used by psychologists such as Jung and others. Freud called it the superego. Other schools of psychology have termed it the universal mind or universal consciousness. It may be compared to the guardian angel of some religions. The kahunas believed it had evolved much farther than the two lower selves, and acted as a sort of a personal god who, at one time, was a member of one's clan or family. This self did not live in the body and could travel to far places. It was, nevertheless, considered a true part of the man. The Egyptian kahuna priests spoke of these three selves or minds as the I, the middle self, the sun, or the lower animal self, and the Holy Spirit as the Father, Mother, or High Self. The Christians say Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. For convenience sake, we will refer to the three minds as the low self, the middle self for the conscious mind, and the high self for the superconscious. One can think of these three selves as energy levels. The advent of Planck and the quantum theory and Einstein, our understanding of the world in which we live has undergone a tremendous transformation. Instead of a world of dead, inert matter, we are now confronted with a world of motion in the form of energy. What we call matter is seen to be the structural arrangement of energy fields, ranging from the simple hydrogen molecule to the most complex protein molecule. We ourselves are living fields of energy. Huna corroborates all that modern psychology knows of the subconscious and conscious parts of the mind. However, it adds a considerable amount of information about their nature and the special abilities and powers of these parts of our mind. Huna also presents the superconscious and shows its particular characteristics. There is a correlation between Planck's quantum theory of man as a living bioelectrical field of energy levels and the ancient belief of the three levels of energy used by the three selves of man. The Huna psychology provides modern man with constructs to use in the understanding of his mental and spiritual makeup, tools for understanding the structure and function of man. From this ancient understanding, there developed a system by which the elements of man can be made to function in cooperation with each other. There are concepts and techniques which we have not had time to discuss, concepts which were understandable in the most unscientific world of the ancient kahunas. These concepts, when understood as constructs, can be used by modern man to master the force or power that is within. Through the use of these constructs, one can achieve the desirable things of life. This secret system is intangible, but it is powerful. Through this system, you can create in your mind success, whether it be measured in terms of money, power, health, happiness, harmonious family and business relations, or peace of mind.